Welcome to Sports Life Balance, hosted by John Moffat.
At NASA, we have a saying that together everyone achieves more, TEAM. And so teamwork in our business is crucial because of the consequences of not really working well together. And so I felt like that ability to communicate well within a team and to put team above self was something I learned through sports. And at NASA, that's what we need. We need everyone to work together. Clear communication is crucial in our business also. A lot of times we don't have a lot of time to discuss something. And that's true in team sports, for example, the ability to communicate really clearly. The meticulous preparation is really important, not only just for the astronauts, but for also for the flight controllers. And so that, of course, is something that comes from sports. The ability to make decisions under pressure in a short amount of time. Recognize that when something bad happens, you have to come up with these creative solutions immediately, and you need to act. I mean, so many times we think of solutions and we don't actually take action. Well, in sports, you have to.
That's Steve Smith, two-time Stanford National Water Polo Champion and Space Shuttle Astronaut. I'm John Moffat, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Sports Life Balance. Steve's dream of someday going to space began at just 7 years old. He carried those dreams with him as he excelled at water polo, graduated with a master's degree in electrical engineering, and embarked on a career at IBM. But Steve's road to being an astronaut was filled with years of setbacks and obstacles. And each time he was rejected, he searched for new options to fulfill his enormous ambition. Eventually, Steve would fly on 4 space shuttle missions, spending more than 49 hours walking in space. For 5 of his 7 spacewalks, he repaired the Hubble Space Telescope, orbiting 340 miles above the Earth. But for all of Steve's setbacks and achievements, it was a near-death experience when he was just 15 years old that permanently changed the trajectory of his life. Steve, I am so happy to be here, actually in Silicon Valley, in San Jose, the place where you grew up, to talk to you about your amazing life journey on Sports Life Balance. Thank you for joining me.
Well, John, I'm a big fan. It's an honor to be here with you. So thanks for making the journey.
Well, I take that as quite a compliment from someone like you. Well, then let's dig in. Like I said, you spent much of your time in San Jose growing up. What brought your family here? Why are you here in San Jose, and why have you been here so long?
Yeah, so my dad is an electrical engineer, Arizona State grad, and when he graduated, IBM was one of the big tech companies, and they had a big location here. And so he took the job here at the San Jose plant site and ended up working for IBM for nearly 50 years. And, you know, all these things that happen in your family life, some of them really stand out as being influential. And so for me, the opportunity to grow up in Silicon Valley was huge because here people think big. They put up with setbacks along the way. They know when to pivot and when to be resilient. And so to have that kind of as the environment here was really helpful to me in formulating kind of who I was and wow, how I approached big ideas.
So it was kind of in the water, or is this sort of like a shared sort of zeitgeist that this place has? What is it about Silicon Valley, you think, that?
Oh, I think it was just the environment, having people around come over to play poker with my dad, or you'd go to a party, or you'd hear about the stories of someone who was thinking of something just crazy. I mean, just this crazy out of the box idea. And so having that kind of be influential when you're young is huge, because I realized that when I was trying to resolve a problem, for example, it wasn't necessarily solutions A or B that would work. It was option X that maybe no one had even thought of before. So it just taught me to think big and actually to be perseverant, because, you know, these people who think big in this area get kicked in the teeth all the time and keep going.
Yeah, indeed. And I believe from a very young age, you were actually thinking big. I've seen pictures that you drew as a young boy of you as an astronaut. It always seems to be sort of like a self-portrait too.
It's pretty amazing to think back now that even at the age of maybe 6 or 7, I was drawing astronauts doing spacewalks. And to have that come true is kind of, it's a dream come true. It's basically what it is. But, you know, it was 30 years between drawing those pictures and actually stepping out the door of discovery. You know, I was watching the astronauts on television. Jacques Cousteau was exploring the undersea world. So mm-hmm. We were exploring outer space. He was exploring inner space. And so I was just kind of under their spell There were lots of shows on TV that were, fictional shows,
right?
Like Sea Hunt and Lost in Space that I was also watching. So I was getting this dose of the exploration life.
Wow. Yeah, from a very young age. Sports also played a major role in your upbringing as well. What were some of the sports that you were gravitating toward as a young kid?
Now, sports is one of the top activities that really led to my becoming an astronaut. So early on, it was swimming and basketball and baseball. Mm. Eventually, I let baseball go and focused on basketball and swimming. And when you combine those two, it's this other sport called water polo, which is big out here in California, of course. So that's why I eventually ended up in water polo.
Yeah. And now, did you start swimming when you were in Japan?
So I started swimming here in San Jose when I was about six, because my dad's company, IBM, actually had a swim meet for the employees' children. And so at nearby Willow Glen High School, I can still remember my first swim meet. And I was maybe 6 or 7 years old. Only did one length of the pool in each race, 25 yards. And so that race went pretty well, and I enjoyed it. And that really kind of sparked my interest in sports. I will tell you a funny story. The second race was like the 25 freestyle, and the gun went off. I jumped, dove into the water. About halfway through, I kind of felt like something was pulling on me. I just fought through it, got to the other end, touched the end, looked up, and all the other swimmers were still at the starting block end. What had happened is they had called a false start, probably on me. Oh. They dropped the rope in the water, but no one had told me as a 6 or 7 year old that if you feel a rope, you should stop. So I kept going. Perseverance, right?
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, it's funny because the reason it's, I kind of jumped the gun a little bit saying, oh, did you learn how to swim in Japan? Because I just had the pleasure of meeting your dad.
Yeah.
And we're here in the house that you grew up in. And he mentioned that you started swimming in Japan, but the other thing is that you got to fly a lot back and forth,
yes.
Right? And so you caught that
yes.
flying bug, didn't
yes.
you? At,
yes.
Like how old were you when this was kind of starting to take hold?
Yeah, so really that move to Japan really influenced me both in sports and in flying. Really good catch on your part, because in those days, flying commercial was kind of new and kind of exciting. The Boeing 707 was coming out then. So we would fly from San Francisco to Japan, two or three times per year. My parents would have me wear a coat and tie. I mean, it was really kind of a special experience.
Wow.
And I just totally loved flying. I just fell in love with aviation from that. We actually would take a helicopter from San Jose Airport up to San Francisco Airport to catch the flight then.
Wow.
I mean, then it was economically feasible. And so just this love of aviation came from that right away. In parallel, of course, again, watching the astronauts on television and watching, just explorers in all different fields. But in terms of swimming, in Japan, I went to the American School in Japan, and they had a very strong swimming program.
Hmm.
And so we would have big practices every day. We would compete against the military bases and also Japanese swim clubs. And so I really learned there the value of practice, because I could just tell, wow, I'm going faster this week than I did last week. And I could see kind of the changes in my body. And of course, there's so much else that comes with sports, the camaraderie, the travel. Mm-hmm. I mean, here I am in another foreign country. We're traveling to other places, friendships, et cetera. So yeah, fell in love with both aviation and swimming.
Wow. And so at what age then did your father's job at IBM bring you back here into San Jose?
Yeah. So sixth grade, we came back here.
Okay.
And again, just jumped right into, the American sports scene.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't quite as intense as it is these days, but joined, the swimming, baseball, and basketball programs in the neighborhood.
Right. So just kind of at that point, just aspirational as far as you wanting to take your athletics someplace. Mm-hmm. But you still hadn't lost contact with that little dream, that audacious dream that you had as a boy. You still kind of kept that close, didn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They were in parallel. I mean, I wanted to be a pilot and then become an astronaut. Again, collecting magazines, stories, going to the library and reading books about the explorers of the day, especially the astronauts. But in parallel, falling in love with the Olympics.
Mm.
I mean, my dream was to follow your footsteps, basically. And so when the Olympics would come along, I would actually create scrapbooks from the local newspapers.
Really?
Every day, winter or summer, I wasn't picky. I would actually create these scrapbooks about the Olympics. So for me, the goal of being an Olympian was just as strong as the goal of being an astronaut. And I recently just found a journal I had. I'm not a big journal writer, but I did keep them for a while. And in the in September of 1985, I was just about to finish business school. And the last page before I started school, I actually wrote my dreams out. And one said, you know, Seoul, 1988, and the other said to become a NASA mission specialist. So that dream really carried on for many decades.
Yeah, dreams are important. They're definitely important. And I found, I was a kid not growing up with really any particular dream whatsoever. And then somehow swimming found me.
Yeah.
So I was very different than you. I just figured out that I was really good at something. And then the dream took hold. But unlike you, you've had this dream close to you, like since you were a little kid. But life also has setbacks. And you were dealt a pretty big blow. Was it your sophomore year in high school?
Yes.
And was it as a result of an injury? What, tell me about that setback that you experienced.
Sure. It was November of my junior year, was playing really competitive basketball and was having some success at it. Hurt my back and didn't tell my parents, just because I just didn't feel like it was worthy of telling my parents. Mm-hmm. So I started self-medicating with aspirin, not knowing that it was dangerous to take large amounts of aspirin. And so, you know, just, gosh, 50 feet from where we're talking in the back bedroom there, I woke up in the middle of the night with massive blood in the bed, basically, because I had burned a hole in my intestinal system. And so, you know, we rushed me to the hospital. In those days, the technology couldn't find what the problem was for about 3 days. And so for every pint of blood they'd put in, a pint would come out.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, ministers coming to the bedside, and I'm sure my parents were wondering if their kid was going to make it. But anyway, you know, after they figured it out, and after 11 days I came home. But, you know, it really changed my life. Really, these near-death experiences you often hear really formulate a person's value system and their interests and their clarity on life. And I can tell you, you know, I came out with my life a big scar, but also this set of, you know, beliefs and practices that I really carry forward to this day. And it just happened, like I said, just, you know, 50 feet from where we're sitting.
So. Wow, that's crazy. So it's just, it's kind of it really snapped you into really, really appreciating what you have.
Yeah. And, you know, as a 15-year-old boy, that's pretty remarkable.
I was going to say.
I mean, I think probably at the time I just kind of moved on. You know, but really over the years, I reflected back on it and I thought, wow, you know, in some ways that was a real gift. And when I speak to crowds now, I try to emphasize how this clarity of life's purposes and how to live it is so valuable, and that they don't need to go through some really bad experience, because there's so many people out there who have overcome amazing experiences that give them this clarity. And including several of your guests and, you know, your experience. So I was really lucky in that respect.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So you were able to rebound physically fairly quickly?
Yes. I mean,
obviously, emotionally, you were like renewed by this experience.
Yeah. 30 days later, I went to basketball practice, 30 days with this, you know, 16-inch scar on my stomach. And I remember Coach Scott, who was the sophomore basketball coach, didn't show any concern for my, you know, health. He wanted to really toughen me up and actually put me in some pretty aggressive drills that first day against some of the bigger players on the team. So
what was it was time to apply to college, and your dream was to take that next step toward being an astronaut. And what was that then?
Yeah. So my dream was to go to the United States Air Force Academy. One of my teammates' father, took he and I to a swim meet in Longmont, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were there, we went to the Air Force Academy. And I just, you know, fell in love with the place. Yeah. I already knew about it. I already knew that's the place I wanted to go, because every single astronaut ever chosen by NASA had been a military pilot. And so for me, it was the Air Force Academy. So I applied, which was, again, this is just about a year after this, you know, near-death experience. And I was invited to my flight physical nearby Moffett Field. And that physical lasted maybe a minute, because the doctor came in with all my paperwork and, you know, had read about my medical history that had occurred just 12 months earlier and said, you know, Mr. Smith, you're disqualified from ever being a United States military pilot. So when that's the only pathway to becoming an astronaut, you know, I was devastated.
Yeah.
And, you know, went home and had a good cry that night with my parents in this house.
Wow.
But, you know, that Silicon Valley mindset and that explorer mindset really kicked in within a day or two. And it just said, you know, there's got to be some creative solution to keep going. You love this goal. And, you know, anytime you love something, it's going to give you this inspiration to continue. And, you know, many people talk about this intersection of preparing yourself for a moment of opportunity. And so for me, I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll have to pivot. Maybe there's a good school nearby. They have a good engineering program. And, oh, and by the way, they had the best water polo team in the country this year. And they have an airport nearby and a flying club. So that's why I decided to go to Stanford. And I thought, you know, if I become a civilian pilot, maybe there's some joyous path ahead to being a civilian pilot. And, you know, frankly, in the next couple of years, NASA changed the rules. And they said, you don't have to be a military pilot.
Oh.
So, in fact, they took some non-pilots and scientists and engineers in the late 70s.
Well, Stanford might not have been the adventure that you were expecting, but I mean, you were able to do some really cool things. I mean, you mentioned, of course, the Pilots Club and things like that, studying electrical engineering. But you were also on the water polo team, and you were quite successful as a member of that team. And the team was very successful with you part of it, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I was lucky to play with some amazing people.
Yeah.
And the team was really good. We had a great coach and Dante. But it really took the level of skills that you learn through sports to another level. I mean, intercollegiate athletics is this big step up. And I am very clear when I speak to crowds that, you know, there's different contributions to who you are and to your success that come along the way. But, you know, through sports, I learned all of life's important skills. And Steve Young actually has a great quote about that, that he learned all of life's important skills through sports. And so for me, it really was one of the cornerstone skill gathering experiences that helped me overcome all these setbacks that were to come and that had come and to make it and to, you know, be successful at it.
And you went on, you won two national championships, the second of which you were the captain.
Yeah, what an honor.
And
I think it goes to show you that, you know, when you're in a particular field, it's not just the hard skills that you have, these workman skills that excel, because I was not the best water polo player on that team by far, distance. We, in fact, had three future Olympians on that team. But it's also your soft skills, your leadership skills, your communication skills, your work ethic, the brand that you carry. And so I, you know, I really attribute that selection as a leader in that situation to not being the best person on the team, but to having kind of this different skill set of soft skills. And I hope that all of, you know, your listeners think about that when they're pursuing their big dreams, that you don't necessarily have to have the best hard skills for what you're doing. In fact, I think companies often have so many good employees applying these days for a position that they, down select on hard skills, but then they make their final selections on soft skills.
Do you think there's an element of those soft skills were developed in you because you weren't the star on the team and that you needed to make up for?
Yeah, no, you're always looking for your place to contribute. And I was so joyous being on that team, just loved the physical fitness of it and the travel and the camaraderie. It was really just this kind of, you know, well, like fraternity or brotherhood for me. And so, of course, yeah, you're always looking for how can I help this team? Well, I'll be the guy who will show up every day 5 minutes earlier than everybody, whatever it takes. And again, that's a great life lesson to learn in business and in parenting and friendship too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I mean, I had the same experience on the Stanford team is that the leaders were not necessarily the best swimmers, the ones scoring the most points. And it just is, it's a tribute to, as you say, the soft skills and how important those things are and how much they help with the chemistry, the overall chemistry, because chemistry of a group is also vital, that there's, you know, people trust each other, and that people listen to each other and understand each other.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny because I think I remember at the time, you know, you're only what, around 20 years old at that point. I remember thinking, oh, the good players are probably too busy, so the coach wants to give the captain job to somebody else. You know, you just, you don't even think too much with the, at the time. You know, maybe it's you're just trying to be humble in that role or whatever. I don't know. But I remember thinking at the time, it'll probably help them concentrate on the the games.
And it was, we were talking just a little bit earlier with your dad, and it was a bit of a rarefied air type of group. You mentioned that there were three on your team. There are three people that would go on to compete in the Olympic Games. And there are also three doctors. And one of them was an Olympian and a doctor.
Correct. I mean, that's... Yeah. And the seventh one was an astronaut. So the starting seven was this really interesting mix of, well, of intercollegiate athletics, right?
You got
this combination of academics and athletics. So
magic. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you got your master's in electrical engineering as well. So you went 5 years at Stanford, and then you followed in your father's footsteps. And, I mean, maybe you wouldn't put it that way, but you went to IBM.
Correct. Yeah. The military wasn't an option still because I only wanted to be a pilot, and they still wouldn't take me because of that physical constraint. So I thought, what's the next most creative thing to do in terms of building engineering skills and having time still to practice aviation in the civil aviation area? And so I did that. But at the whole time I was there, I was still started applying to NASA and still dreaming of getting that position as an astronaut in the astronaut corps.
So, well, then what did you do about trying to become an astronaut at that point? You're at IBM.
Sure.
You're an engineer. I'm not sure what kind of engineer, but...
Yeah, we were making semiconductors. It was kind of the dawn age of fabricating semiconductors with all this magical chemistry and physics and photolithography. But, NASA started, as I said, selecting non-military people while I was at Stanford. So when I got to IBM... I was eligible to apply just as a United States citizen, non-military person to NASA. So I sent in a first application, and it was a very simple application. It's almost strange to fill out a job application to ride a rocket into space, but it asked kind of the same questions as any job application. Anyway, about 2 months after I sent it in, I got a very plain, very small brown envelope from the U.S. government that had just a real short letter in it that said, basically, we don't want you. And, they don't really tell you why. They just say, you know, sorry, we don't want you. And I remember, you know, being really disappointed. But I thought, you know, okay, I'm still early in my early 20s. Maybe they're looking for people a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And so, again, crushed just for a day. But when you've got this big dream, you got to keep moving forward. And so instead of just kind of sitting there the next couple of years until they accept applications again, I tried to better myself. So eventually that's why I went back to business school, learned to scuba dive, flew more airplanes, did some community work, learned to speak in public. So just, again, trying to build up the skill set, paying the price for trying to reach the big dream.
So you just were acquiring skills, hoping that the cumulative effect would be something that would be more desirable by NASA.
Correct.
So you were not going to give up on this.
Oh, no way. No. Yeah. No. And, you know, it was really good to have built up that resilience because... When I applied, you know, 2 years later and 4 years later and 6 years later, they rejected me each time. So over about an 8 or 9 year period, I got 4 rejections. Each time they say, we don't want you, and they don't tell you why. Mm. And, you know, after the third one, I may have even cried a little bit when I got that letter because now I'm in my late 20s.
Yeah.
This is this dream I've had for decades. Maybe even some of my friends are saying, you know, hey, this isn't going to happen. Give up. But, you know, once you've got this passion in your heart, people with this, I call it the explorer's mindset, but anybody with this explorer's mindset or go-getter or winner or trailblazer mindset, you know, you don't give up until you're down on the mat out of choices. And I'd like to think that, you know, the obstacles I was facing were on the path and not blocking the path and just kept trying to think of some creative solution to keep moving forward.
I heard you tell the story about how you were trying to figure out your in, and you even wrote a letter to Sally Ride.
I did, yeah.
And I remember Sally Ride very clearly because she was the first woman astronaut on the space shuttle, Stanford grad.
Yes, sir.
And I was actually one of the lucky people at Stanford who got to sign the American flag that went up.
How
on the space
about
shuttle.
That? I did not know that.
So I feel like
we're connected.
The special kid. Well, wow, that is that's almost disconnected. But no. But I just remember that very clearly. You know, Sally Ride, and you know, it's just like I'm assuming she wrote you back.
She did. Yeah. I mean, again, you know, thinking big, thinking creative. I mean, who would have ever thought that you know the first American woman in space would return a letter that you'd write to her? But I thought I'm going to try, and so that's that lesson again to. Try things, you know, and put the opportunity out there to gather more information from people. And she wrote me back. you know, and basically said, yeah. keep going, keeping, you know, diversified in your efforts, collecting skills, et cetera. So I'm super grateful. I still have the letter. So
that's pretty cool. Yeah. You mentioned, just a few moments ago, you mentioned the explorer's mindset. Explain what you mean by that. What are the elements for somebody who has the explorer's mindset?
Sure. Well, and it can be called different things. Like mm-hmm. I said before, go-getter, high achiever, yeah. entrepreneurs have uh-huh. the same mindset. The first is to have a big goal, a gigantic, audacious goal. You know, we're not looking for little incremental things. We want to go places where people haven't been before or do it in a vehicle that no one's ever used before. So explorers have this big mindset. The second part is that along the way, before they even start, they know they're going to have tough time along the way. Yeah. It's not going to be a straight line from A to B. You're going to get kicked in the teeth. You're going to make mistakes. You might have, you know, these huge setbacks along the way. But because you're anticipating them, you know they're coming. And when they happen, you're not devastated. In fact, you're prepared to come up with a solution to get around them. It's this wildly creative solution. I mean, explorers and people with this mindset are absolutely convinced that whatever's in their way, they can find a solution around it. Pivot and learn and keep going. And so it's this crazy ability to be really creative. I mentioned before, for example, when you're facing these obstacles with this mindset, don't think about just options A and B. Look some other completely different direction where it's X. And in the space program, we have to do that because you know, we're trying to make the impossible possible and the obstacles are huge. And then the third attribute besides the big goal and then this way you carry yourself along the way is to do it for as long as it takes. And so that sustained pursuit of a passion is in modern times called grit. And,
right.
It's all about grit and just, you know, keep going forward. So, you know, when these rejections, first the Air Force and then four from NASA piling up, you know, I loved what I was aiming for. If you look at some of those pictures of me that I drew as a seven-year-old, look at the smile on my face. It's one of these exaggerated U-shaped smiles because I knew that walking outside a spaceship would make me just so joyous.
Well, I guess that's a good reason to pursue a dream, right?
Absolutely.
So the space shuttle program took up, you're talking about, you know, setbacks. Mm-hmm. And a setback is not a broad enough term to describe what happened then on January 28th, 1986. And I remember I was on campus. You were in business school?
Yeah, I was at the gym. I was at the athletes gym
early in the morning. And what I'm speaking of for those who didn't live through it or those that don't know what I'm talking about, it's the space shuttle Challenger exploded a minute or two after takeoff. There was a civilian teacher on board. And it was one of those moments I remember very clearly. You remember where you were, it's mm-hmm. one of those things. And I remember I was in a Shakespeare class and the professor came up to the podium, to start the class. And he was obviously very upset. And he said, the space shuttle just exploded. I'm canceling class. I can't bring myself to teach right now. Yeah. And we all right there. And then pretty much you realized that the entire campus was kind of shut down in collective mourning. This was a big deal. And it was a big deal for the program as well. How did you feel about this? Is this something that you were actively pursuing as your dream?
You know, for the first couple of days, just absolutely devastated. Just feeling for the families of the astronauts. Mm-hmm. Feeling for our country because we were trying to do big things and it happened, you know, on national TV. Yeah. We've got Krista McAuliffe, the first teacher in space on board. At that time, the families of the astronauts weren't really sequestered during the launch. So they were kind of among the crowd. So it was just this really horrible, series of events. I remember reading letters written to the editors of the local paper and national papers and the kind of the Bible of the aerospace industry, Aviation Week and space technology. And I remember there was one in particular, one L-1011 pilot who wrote one sentence that said, you know, knowledge doesn't come to the timid. And so part of gathering information, part of gathering big advancements comes at a price. And so some of those letters said, you know, the crew members on that flight almost certainly would want our country to continue. Figure out what happened, fix it, and let's move on. And so that's the way exploration's been forever. We just don't, you know, read all the books about all the expeditions that have happened before, but exploration comes at a cost. And when I was processing that, I recognized that I was willing to do that, that to the betterment of our world and our society, I would be willing to risk my life. And, you know, I won't be shy in just saying, I also wanted to ride the rocket, of course, and, you know, step outside and do these cool things. But in the end, I knew it was a noble cause. And frankly, to step ahead, when I met my wife, Peggy, and she heard that I wanted to be an astronaut, first of all, she didn't think it would ever happen. But, you know, when it eventually did happen and all of a sudden we're within a couple of days of a couple of years of flying, and we had this conversation where I said, you know, this is why I'm doing it. If we ever have children, I think it'll make their lives better. And as I flew each time, you know, then we started having children and we just had the same conversation. And I think, you know, I I'll just be really kind of open here and just say that before each flight, I wrote letters to every member of the family.
Oh, wow.
And they've never seen those letters, but those letters were to be delivered to them by my best friend should something happen. And, you know, writing a letter to your two-year-old son, that's pretty hard to do. And so all the content of those letters was, I'm so sorry this happened. This is what my thoughts are of you at this time. Like, you're just an amazing young man. You're just an amazing young woman. You're a lovely wife in person. But the rest of the letter would say, please express my interest in the program continuing because we're trying to make the world a better place at NASA. Yeah.
The thing I'm struck by the candidness and the rawness of you know of your story is the fact that it's very easy to sort of like look at people such as astronauts and explorers and that there's something they're you know they're armored with steel and you know they don't feel the same things that we do but clearly
we feel you know we feel that pain too you know it happened again in February 1st of 2003 right. when we lost Columbia. And for our listeners, John's eyes glassed over a little while I was talking about this. But sorry about that, John. But anyway, no, we're just like that. But again, we know it's for the greater cause. And so when people ask, well, why does NASA exist? Why do they have a budget, et cetera? It's to make people's lives better, to gather information to solve issues here on Earth and to help us, you know, maybe progress into the solar system and learn more out there.
Wow, fantastic. Yeah.
But, you know, there's a selfish side of riding the bullet into space is pretty fun, too.
Maybe you could just call it predisposition.
Yeah.
Something that...
And you know what else, John, is, you know, the truth is, and we all do this every day, so this is not just me, but you also think it's going to happen to someone else. It's kind of this defense mechanism. I mean, when we go driving a car, we feel like that. When we fly on airplanes. And so that's, you know, a tough thing to say, but, you know, that was one of the coping mechanisms, frankly.
So you mentioned that you had at this point already applied four times to NASA and been rejected each of the four times. And you upon those setbacks, you figured out a way to rebound. What was your strategy when you were at IBM? What did you decide was the thing that you would have to do in order now to take the next step to actively pursue that dream for
Leave.
A fifth time?
Leave. You know, again, you've got to sometimes change the equation. And, you know, there's that definition of insanity. If something doesn't work and you keep trying doing it over and over and expect some different outcome. One of your speakers may have even mentioned that. But so for me, it was just change the equation. So I left a job I loved at IBM, took a pay cut and moved 1,500 miles from IBM to NASA to become an engineer in a position that five other people had held as an engineer flight controller at NASA in Houston and become astronauts. And so I thought, well, I'll try and do that. I did that despite the fact that my wife and I were about 2 months from getting married here in California. We already had a house here. She had a great job, as did I. But I thought, you know, we've got to change it up. So it's option X. And I went down there to see what it would be like and also to understand the NASA culture and to see if I was would be like working there. To learn about the space shuttle, but also to display my soft skills and to see if that would help change the equation. And it did. It worked. That's exactly what happened.
And and they, that, so, so that move resulted in you getting another shot.
Yeah. So I went down there on June 5th and October 18th, the astronaut selection office called. So this is my, my fifth application, and said, we'd like you to come to the interview group, which means you've gone from a pile of thousands to the last 100, which is just a joyous new step. I couldn't believe I had, you know, progressed finally. So I went home, you know, really happy on that day. Came to work on October 19th, and my boss said, I don't want you to take the interview.
This is your new
boss? My new boss, yeah. And so I remember sitting dumbfounded, you know, angry, upset. Well, why not? And he said, well, you know, you've just got here. It's not fair to me. It's not fair to the team. So I went home very confused, angry, of course. On October 20th, I flew from Houston back here to get married. Peggy and I had our rehearsal dinner on the 21st. On the 22nd, we had the wedding. It was supposed to be at Stanford Memorial Chapel, but the earthquake around here had damaged the church. So we were married on the 22nd in a different church. On the 23rd, we flew to Hawaii. And on the 24th, on my honeymoon, I picked up the phone to call the astronaut selection office and tell them what my decision was. You know, am I going to go against my boss's wishes or take the interview? And so I remember Dwayne Ross answered the phone at the office there and said, and I said, Dwayne, I've made my decision. Aloha, I'm in Hawaii on my honeymoon, but I'm going to turn down the opportunity to interview. And the phone was silent for what seemed like a long time. And then Dwayne said, in no uncertain terms, kind of an adult voice, no one has ever done that to us before. And I said, well, you know, this is my honoring the system and showing grit. I didn't say that. But again, that's, you know, if you have this long-term pursuit, sometimes you got to put in another year or two. And so I knew that they wouldn't select for another couple of years. So at the end of our honeymoon, by the way, you know, I came back to Houston and worked for NASA. Peggy went back to our home in San Jose, San Francisco. And so for the next 2 years, I worked for that manager. My wife had a couple different names for him, so I'll just say Mr. Mean Guy. And anyway, 2 years later, I was selected. So
finally.
Finally. So at the age of 31, I guess, at that point.
So it's kind of your sixth time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
Thank you for reminding me. That's true.
I mean, but that is just nuts. And so the years, I don't need to belabor the point. It was, so that was like, man, you really wanted this.
Yeah. And, you know, again, there's this incident as a young person that really helped develop the grit and skills and this participation in sports. And of course, you know, family and friends influence. So,
you're now in a training program. Is that then after these interviews that you ended up in a training program selected as what, top 19, I think 20, something like that. And I'm sure it was similar to your days like back playing water polo at Stanford, where you've got like these crazy high achievers. I mean, your fellow aspiring astronauts, they have to have been completely gnarly.
Yeah. Yeah. It was 19 Americans. And included at least one person with 6 college degrees. So it was pretty intimidating. And of course, we were also overwhelmed with information. Because we had, you know, different shuttle systems to learn, different spacesuits to learn, you know, geology, meteorology, et cetera. So it was really overwhelming. And then 74 days after I became an astronaut, we had our first child too. So life got pretty complicated at that point.
That's the way life works.
Yeah, yeah. But John, can I just go back to one thing?
Yeah, please.
So I really didn't tell you the whole story. So after I came back from Hawaii, I did work for Mr. Mean Guy for 2 years.
Yeah.
And applied again and made the interview round again. And this time I could accept the interview. And so they provided a very large package of forms to fill out. And so I went home and filled those forms out. But for the first time, the forms that I was giving to NASA asked for a more complete medical history.
Oh.
So up until that point, NASA wasn't really aware of what had happened back in my junior year in high school. Anyway, I put it on the paperwork, turned the paperwork in. Well, 3 days after I turned that paperwork in, I got a call from the astronaut selection office. They called me in and they said, you know, Steve, based on your medical history, you're disqualified from being an astronaut forever because of that medical history. And so, you know, another punch to the gut, another opportunity to go home. And, you know, it's okay to feel that disappointment pain. But in the end, if you've got this big goal, you know, you can't give up. You got to view the obstacle as being on the path. You know, it's just on the path. It's not blocking the path. And you've got to look at all your options. And is there some creative solution you can come up with?
We'll hear more from Steve in a minute. But first, I'm really excited to tell you about our new partner, Roka. Roka was founded by two of my fellow All-American Stanford swimmers, and I've been using their equipment for years. Not just because they're my friends, but because their training and racing gear are seriously second to none in the industry. But what you might not know is that Roka also makes the best performing eyeglasses and sunglasses on the planet. I'm wearing some right now, and they're awesome. They're extremely lightweight, and due to the totally adjustable non-slip nose pads and temples, they never fall off my face, even when I'm hot and sweaty. And best of all, I totally forget that I'm wearing them. Roka has dozens of classic and great-looking styles to choose from. I love being able to use the same pair of glasses for a hard workout or a night on the town. So whether you need prescription glasses like mine or a stylish pair of sunglasses, please go check them out. Head to roka.com, that's R-O-K-A.com, and enter SLB, as in Sports Life Balance. That's three letters, SLB, to save 20% on your first order. And now, let's get back to astronaut Steve Smith.
And so for me, you know, it's really interesting to ask audience members during my speech, what would you have done at this point? Yeah. You just folded in. And so the solution I came up with, which is option X, is to go back to the astronaut selection office. Mm-hmm. They were not happy to see me. They had told me to never come back, to never apply again. But I have to give them credit. They listened. And so I proposed to them that they have their medical personnel identify a very specific medical test that I can have by a very specific doctor at a very specific hospital to gather information to see if there was some way they could clear me from the regulations that I was violating. Mm-hmm. And I would pay for this whole thing on my own. So that's option X. They agreed to it, which to me is, again, a lucky moment. I'm so thankful for that. So anyway, I had the test by their doctor at the hospital of their choice, turned the information into NASA, like 2 months passed.
Oh, man.
And finally, they had the meeting of what's called a Space Medicine Board, SMB. And, you know, I went to a local church and just sat quietly in the pews by myself during their meeting because I didn't know what else to do. But eventually I got a call that night and they said, you know, we've decided to waive the regulation for you. And in fact, we're going to change the regulation for all future applicants.
Wow.
And so just come up with these really creative solutions to these apparent obstacles.
That is just like crazy what you had to go through to become an astronaut. And so you're cleared and then it's,
wow, busy life,
yeah, busy life, but
with a new baby.
Yeah, but so much of that is, it goes back to your training as an athlete, right? I mean, I've seen some of the training that they make you, you know, they exert crazy beyond human G forces mm-hmm. against you. You're in a pool learning how to, I mean, explain what, I mean, I'm assuming that your athletic background was really, really helped you, especially when compared to perhaps some of the other candidates who were not as athletic as you.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, well, it did. Absolutely. From a couple of perspectives. One is, you know, when you're an athlete, you're balancing all these different requirements from the academic side and the athletic side. So you learned lots of different techniques to deal with that. Time management, divide and conquer, prioritize, simplify your life, et cetera, et cetera. And so they absolutely helped. I think it also, the skills like, you know, teamwork, communication, also helped me get through this massive pile of requirements on my life and time.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the end, you know, I attribute, again, sports to help me through moments like this with these great skills. But going back to that incident at this local hospital, San Jose Hospital, room 2S42, you know, I came out of that experience with this new mindset that, you know, life is to live to its fullest, to live joyfully. Yeah. And the only way you can do that is to lead as simple life as possible. Hmm. To get rid of the noise in your life, to quit wasting time, to you know, just find the ability to focus on the things that are really important.
Wow. Yeah.
Like the big goals, the relationships, joy, contributing, being a member of our society that contributes. And so one way to think about it is, you know, if you're juggling a lot of balls in your life, okay, and a couple of them are crystal, you don't want to drop those crystal ones.
Right.
And so if you can get rid of some of the balls that you're juggling, it helps. And so that's why I've always encouraged people to, you know, simplify your life with those techniques. And, you know, I'm not a minimalist, but, you know, I'm not really big on having a lot of possessions and items. I'm really more interested in experience and time. And so that's how I got through that astronaut training. I really had that sports background, but also this simplify your life mindset. It leads to balance. You know, I not only wanted to be a great astronaut, but when I go home, I wanted to be a good spouse and a good dad,
right.
a good community member, a good family member to my parents and sibling. And so the only way I could do that was to simplify my life. And it worked.
I can only imagine how incredibly overwhelming just the controls and all the different forces that are being thrown at you. And then there's the politics and the pressure and then all these things that are going along with.
Yeah, you got to get as many things off the list as you can. Mm. And, you know, we hold on to things for a long time sometimes and don't need to. I think we forget to slow down once in a while and say, okay, these are the things on my priority list. Are there any there that, you know, I've carried for a long time? And, you know, I'll give you an example. And when I was 16, I bought a 1966 Corvette, Nassau Blue 427 engine, had like 26,000 miles on it.
Dang.
I loved that car for a long time. And it was, you know, in high school, it's like at the top of my priority list.
Yeah.
Well, I held on to that car for 42 years. And every year it slid down the list, yet it stayed in my possession. It took my time, but it wasn't just as important. So finally I said, you know, I'm going to simplify my life. It's on the list. It doesn't deserve to be anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I won't say that that wasn't painful, but it was an easy, obvious decision. So I got rid of the car. And a lot of my friends, when they heard that, said, oh my gosh, you know, that's your thing. That's your identity. I said, no, you know, I have these other things in my life now that are higher priority. So
one of the things that you mentioned that I have the hardest time with is wasting time.
Yeah.
I'm really good at wasting time.
John, I tell crowds, I'm going to talk about this subject, but it's not like I've mastered it. We are constantly getting distracted. It's okay. The internet's made it worse. I've been on airplanes where I'm watching a movie that someone's watching two rows ahead of me, and even though I can't hear the sound, I mean, it's human nature. But it's a good reminder to constantly try not to waste too much time. And, you know, I tell people, if you can only save 10 minutes a day, that's like 3 full days per year. Think about that. If you could get 3 full days per year. So, you know, don't watch as many cat videos, maybe cut it down a little bit. If you're doing some kind of an activity, a sport or, you know, a skill, instead of doing it 5 times per week, maybe do it 4 times per week. It's pretty easy to find places that save time. It doesn't mean you need to be boring. You know, you want to have this balanced, joyful life, but there are some excessive probably things that you can cut out.
Yes, indeed. Well, so the training is, your first round of training is through and you're selected. And it would be September of 1994.
Yes.
You have found yourself successfully going through all the training and you are sitting atop a rocket.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what that must be like. How do you describe that to somebody?
Well, so it's pad 39B at the Kennedy Space Center. We're sitting on board Endeavor and giddy is definitely a feeling you're having at this point. You know, it's something you've dreamed about for decades. I'm around 33 years of age at that point. I'm sure people are interested. Are you like scared at all at that point? And you're going to be surprised to hear the answer is no. Even though I didn't have like a military training background, the preparation that we went through in the 2 years leading up to that made us meticulously prepared. And anytime you have a big event or big thing you're going through, if you're prepared, it really reduces your anxiety. You know, whether it's a test or a PowerPoint presentation or a speech or an athletic event, if you prepared, it's going to help you a lot, of course. Now, having said that, there was high anxiety because you are worried about making a mistake that could cost money to the United States of America. You could hurt a crewmate. You could embarrass your country, your family, et cetera. So you definitely have that burden of worry. God, have I got this all memorized? So again, it's this mixture of joy, anxiety. My wife and I did discuss before I went to the launch pad that, hey, at this point in the launch countdown, let's just have some mindfulness and think about each other. So at L minus 2 minutes, 2 minutes before launch. And then the rest of the time, just I was trying to prepare reviewing emergency procedures. Mm-hmm. What's my role as we go uphill? If something bad happens, if we lose an engine, if we break a window, if we have to jump out, whatever, what's my role? Just making sure I was part of the team, ready to go. The ride into space was unbelievable.
Well, to use a sports metaphor, from what I understand, there was a bit of a false start the first time. Describe that to me.
Yes. So 32 seconds before launch, the space shuttle's five computers take over and do all the processing at that point. So the big computer systems at the Kennedy Space Center are no longer involved. 6 seconds before launch, the three engines start that use liquid hydrogen and oxygen. Those engines are running for 6 seconds to make sure they're okay before we start. They take a little bit while to throttle up. So before L minus zero launch time, the engines are running for 6 seconds. Well, at 1.8 seconds before launch, those computers determined one of those three engines was bad.
Oh.
You definitely don't want to launch with one of those three bad off the launch pad because you're not going to come back. Basically, we're going to have to go to a certain altitude and jump out. No one's ever had to do that. We weren't sure if it would even work. So the engine shut down. Hmm. And so the space shuttle's rocking back and forth, back and forth. There's all kinds of, you know, smoke from the engines running. There's these giant water sprinkler systems spraying the back of the shuttle so there's no fire. And so inside, the alarms are going off, you know, it was kind of a big letdown. It's pretty dangerous moment because you've had, you know, 3,000 degree engines firing in the back. You've got, you know, 600,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen 2 feet from you in the orange tank. But of course, everything was fine and we didn't have to evacuate. We take our seatbelts off right away. Of course, it's much harder 3 miles away where my family is because all of a sudden they see the shuttle still on the launch pad and all this smoke. And, you know, in the cockpit on an abort like that, and even during a successful rise into space, in the cockpit, we're okay. You know, we're, you know, excited about what we're doing. We've trained hard for this. We're pretty sure everything's going to turn out okay. And frankly, if something bad happens, we're gone. You know, it's not going to be like this terrible experience we're going through. We're just going to be gone in an instant. Well, for the families, it's not that way. They're watching from 3-6 miles away somewhere in there. And they're just carrying the drama of this whole thing. And they, of course, would live with the consequences. And so for that reason, I view the families as the real heroes of the space program.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
Yeah. So anyway, we couldn't launch on that day.
Yeah.
They took that bad engine out, put another one in, and 6 weeks later, we had the real experience, which was awesome.
So the real experience.
Yeah.
You actually lift off this time.
Yep.
Tell me about that ride.
It's joyful. It's violent because inside you're just getting thrown around left and right. I mean, we have our seatbelts on, of course, but it's like being on a really old, really bad roller coaster. You're getting thrown left, right, up and down, forward, backward. So you're trying to just kind of just maintain your view of the computer in front of you or the checklist in front of you. You're facing massive acceleration forces at the same time because we're going from the launch pad to Mach 25 in 8.5 minutes. That's 17,500 miles an hour. And so you experience gravitational forces about 3 times what you normally feel here on the face of the Earth. So I weigh about 200 pounds. So going into space, I weighed 600 pounds. Oof. Your arm's heavy. Your head's heavy. All the blood's kind of going to the back of your head. The third thing that's happening is this massive joy. You know, 3 decades, all these rejections. Mm-hmm. I'm riding a United States spaceship into outer space, and we're going to do cool things up there. And so it goes by kind of in a blink of an eye, and all of a sudden the engine shut off, and you're in this magical place. No gravity. Yeah.
It's your first time. I mean, you've been trained in zero gravity.
Simulators.
Yeah. Okay.
And launch simulators, yeah.
But this is your first time. Yeah,
there's no substitute for being there.
Well, what's it like? The first time you're just kind of, whoa.
Yeah, it's really strange because, well, first of all, you see this beautiful blue marble out the window.
Mm.
And I'd love to talk a little bit more about that. It's this moment of awe. But in terms of the experience of being in zero gravity, it's like a movie or a magical show. You know, your listeners can imagine if we could turn off the gravity where they're sitting right now, look at all the things around the room in that you're in that would just kind of start floating up towards the ceiling, including you and the chair and the table. And if there's liquid in a glass next to you, it's going to come out. And so you just kind of eventually you'll float up and touch the ceiling. And it's just wild because even heavy things can be moved around easily. For example, if you could turn gravity off wherever you are now and got a family member or friend, you could play catch with a refrigerator and just use two fingers to kind of pass a refrigerator back and forth. The Hubble Space Telescope weighs 24,000 pounds. And if the system that would deploy it back into space didn't work, two of us were going to go out there, pick it up and push it into space. And it's 24,000 pounds. So it's a very magical place. You can sleep on the ceiling or the wall because our sleeping bags have Velcro on them and the surfaces all have Velcro. And, you know, it's just like a magic show. Just like a magic show. And I have to say that I still dream about it a couple times per year and I wake up with a big smile on my face.
How could you not? How could you not? So I remember years and years ago, you know, reading and hearing about the Hubble Space Telescope, and you were one of the astronauts that were sent up on your second mission to go and fix the Hubble telescope. How far up off of the surface of the Earth is it?
Yeah, so the Hubble Space Telescope has to be put as high in the sky as possible so that the atmosphere that we live in right here on Earth doesn't affect the pictures. So it's at 400 miles approximately.
Whoa.
350 to 400 miles. So that's much higher than all the other space shuttle missions. For example, my first mission was the lowest ever at 120 miles. So we're way up above the Earth. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so, you know, working with Hubble was just a magical experience.
And this was your first spacewalk.
Correct.
As well. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you described weightlessness.
Sure. Yeah. Well, on Earth, we practice in a pool because there's kind of no magical place where you can turn off gravity. The pool is really good in that we put pretend spaceships in there. We put pretend spacesuits on and then we practice the spacewalks. But, you know, there's drag in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And when you turn upside down in the water to do something that you would do upside down in space, there's gravity. The blood goes to your head. Well, when you go and do a spacewalk in the real place, it's incredible because you don't have the window frames blocking your view anymore. You have this big, gigantic visor on your helmet. You have a 300-pound suit on, but in space, it doesn't weigh anything.
Right, right.
So together with my body weight, I was basically like a 500-pound blob, but I felt like a ballerina because I could move around easily. And the view of the Earth, you know, outside the shuttle is just stunning. And there, of course, is this beautiful, magical instrument called the Hubble Space Telescope. And I get to go fix it.
and so you were there hovering in space, for lack of a better term. This is a $6 billion telescope. Yes. There are major stakeholders. There are a lot of eyeballs on this. Not to mention that there is the run-of-the-mill inherent danger. Run-of-the-mill, did I really say that? The inherent danger of a spacewalk. I mean, how do you remain focused and how do you remain calm just and completely task-oriented?
It has to do with the training. Again, having had this meticulous preparation for hundreds and hundreds of hours in this fake place, believe it or not, prepared us for this real place. Now, I'm a little bit oversimplifying it,
right,
but when I got to the real Hubble Space Telescope, I had never seen it before in my life. And yet I was able to know exactly what to do because I had worked on pretend Hubble Space Telescopes, both in the pool and a really high fidelity one, which means a highly accurate one on Earth. And so I was able to feel like it was second nature. I know exactly which bolt to turn. I know which door to turn. And we do that so you can deal with the other dramas and the other danger that, you know, that's going on at the same time. I mean, the suits we wear have 13 layers of materials to protect us. The layer that keeps the oxygen inside is only 4 millimeters thick. And so, you know, wow, that's a pretty dangerous place to be. There's no air there. I mean, if that 4 millimeter fabric gets a hole in it, we're in serious trouble out there. You know, again, it's kind of trying to compartmentalize the danger, put it behind you, try not to focus on it. We are prepared if something happens. So I felt very confident many times in the simulations that material did fail. So they go, oh, Steve, you have a hole in your suit. What are you going to do? So they train you how to deal with that.
All right.
In fact, most of the training is on the emergency situations, not on the normal plan. I think the sports training really helped a lot because, again, you are preparing for these big moments, these big events. You've got coping skills you developed in terms of, you know, deep breathing, mental exercises to keep you focused on what you're doing. And so for me, it was a blast working on this thing. I wish they hadn't told me it was worth $6 billion like a week before we left, because that's when my anxiety went way up. Because again, you've got these stakeholders watching you, and it's really super expensive piece of equipment.
Did you take any moments just for yourself, just to take a deep breath and look around and figuratively pinch yourself?
Absolutely. Not enough, but absolutely. You know, we're super busy up there, but we all know that, you know, there comes a 5 or 10 seconds or a minute where, you know, you can just take a breather. Maybe you're coming up on the coast of Namibia and can just, you know, just take in that beauty of coming across the Atlantic to this beautiful sight. I mean, Namibia is one of the most beautiful coasts to see from space. But for the most part, you're pretty focused. Now, inside the spaceship, you have a little bit more time to have some downtime. But when you're out there spacewalking, you're pretty much on the game plan most of the time. But yeah, we always take a moment. Like for taking pictures, for example.
Yeah.
So before the spacewalk, you would say, hey, if I make this little signal, Rex or John, I'm gonna take your picture. I'm not gonna say it out loud. I just, you know, just take a moment. And I'll take a couple pictures of you. So we had little hand signals when we wanted to do some fun things.
Oh, gosh, I can't imagine. I could talk to you about it.
The stakeholders did not know about those, right?
That's okay. Just get the job done. They didn't need to know.
It's amazing, though, what meticulous practice does for you in anything, in any venture. You know, I'm sure in sports you were nervous at the starting line a little bit.
Of course.
You know, that just means you're loving it and you're anxious to get it done. But a lot of it's almost robotic after that.
That kind of training, I heard you speak a term that struck me as I'd never heard it before, and that the term is, to use the NASA vernacular, when something goes wrong, off nominal.
Yeah.
Well, we all hit off nominal moments in our lives as well. So, do you think that your experiences to get to the point where you got as an astronaut have shed some light on life and those moments that all of us inevitably face, of those off-nominal moments in life?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I thought that was a word that I had always used before I went to NASA, but, you know, in hindsight, it's kind of a NASA vernacular. But, absolutely. I mean, it's funny how your job can train you for life, too. Mm. And so here we are to think very calmly in very dangerous situations, very slowly, to prioritize the options, to be creative, to be prepared to take action. In space. And so I know that, you know, in my personal life, in the time since those flights, I've used those skills here also.
Yeah, definitely valuable lessons. And this is like quite a continuum of athletic prowess into doing something that's just completely extraordinary and beyond what most people aspire to, much less succeed in. In all, you spent nearly 50 hours, 49 hours and change on spacewalks. There's 7 separate spacewalks. Mm-hmm. And then you're actually in the top 5 in the world for most time spent.
Yeah, it's probably 10 by now, but somewhere in there.
It but you were talk about rarefied air, and there's no air up there, but
technically correct. That's exactly right. That's why we have those white spacesuits on.
Well, so you were able to do 2 more missions, and when you think back on those missions, what is the grand, like, 30,000-foot view of what athletics did for you on each one of those 4 missions?
Oh, geez, so many things, John. First of all, at NASA we have a saying that together everyone achieves more. TEAM. And so teamwork in our business is crucial because of the consequences of not really working well together. And so I felt like that ability to communicate well within a team and to put team above self was something I learned through sports.
Mm-hmm.
And at NASA, that's what we need. We need everyone to work together. Clear communication is crucial in our business also. A lot of times we don't have a lot of time to discuss something. And that's true in collegiate or in team sports, for example, mm-hmm. the ability to communicate really clearly. The meticulous preparation is really important, not only just for the astronauts, but for also for the flight controllers. And so that, of course, is something that comes from sports. The ability to make decisions in under pressure in mm-hmm. a short amount of time. That's what sports is all about, too. Mm-hmm. The ability to recognize that when something bad happens, you have to come up with these creative solutions immediately, and you need to act. I mean, so many times we think of solutions, and we don't actually take action. Well, in sports, you have to.
Yeah.
You really have to. And just the value of just practicing over and over these basic skills so that they don't necessarily end up having you use the same skill in the moment, but they've given you the ability to vector off into things that are close by to resolve an issue, for example.
Well, and it served you well. You finished, your last mission was in 2002, and you stayed as an employee of NASA, and you tackled some leadership positions. One of them, which was deputy chief astronaut, tell me what exactly that means.
So in the astronaut corps, we had about 130 astronauts at the time, and there's leaders of the NASA corps. So we had the chief astronaut was Charlie Precourt, and I was the deputy chief astronaut. And we kind of divided the work up in that he was doing the kind of the up and out. So the politics, the talking to, you know, NASA headquarters and other space agencies around the world. And my job was to manage the daily lives of the astronauts in the corps. And I have to say, wow, that was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. One of the most challenging, because you can imagine the skills and capabilities and creativity of that group of people. Humbling in many ways. I really think that some of the skills, again, I learned as an athlete helped me be successful at that job in terms of coming up with teamwork, motivating the other members, communicating really well to them, even if it was bad news, you know, learning to communicate well. And so, wow, that was a wild, wild job, but I really enjoyed it.
And then from there, you moved on to a diplomat in Europe. Explain to me what that was exactly.
Yeah, so my role as a diplomat was to represent NASA largely to the European Space Agency, which is made up of about 20 different countries, and then also at times to the Russian Space Agency when we were talking about space station issues. Mm-hmm. We built the space station as a collaborative effort among many countries. It's an amazing facility that's the size of about a football field, has 6 to 9 people living on board and weighs about 100 tons. It's traveling at 17,500 miles an hour. But it had been largely built by first the Russians and Americans, but then we started including our Japanese partners, our Canadian partners, and our European partners. And so my job was to be the liaison between NASA and those countries, especially in Europe. And so that involved, you know, financial discussions, politics, bartering things. We didn't ever exchange money for things, but it was always about bartering different services. And the space station is really a wonderful example of international cooperation. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised, for example, if it's not nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize someday, because despite all the saber rattling going on between the countries politically, we've continued to work together in space successfully for a long time.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's like actually really heartening, because you only hear about how bad the relationship has become between us and
engineers, and scientists, pilots. We just want to work together on a technical basis and get the job done, get the data, and help move the world forward in that respect.
Well, and I will tell you that athletes are the same way. You know, when I was in Europe and competing, and when the big news was that the United States was going to boycott the Moscow Games in 1980, I just remember all the Soviet and East German swimmers. They would come up to me individually and say, please don't boycott.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that point you're human to human, you know, they want to compete against you. You all just want to compete. And so, you know, I love that. And I just never thought about it, that space and athletics are like it's sort of like equal playing field where we can all cooperate and
Great, it's yeah.
That magic.
Great diplomatic communities, right? To keep us moving forward together. Yeah, I had never thought of that either. But yeah. Just like you said, I mean, astronaut to cosmonaut, you know, there's no interest in the politics that are going on
right.
on Earth, frankly.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Well,
what a parallel.
That makes me happy. I'm going to ask you to reflect one more time. What would that little boy who drew spaceships and the self-portraits with a big smile on your face, what would he think of this audacious dream that he had that had become reality? And how would he look upon that? And
probably didn't realize that it was as big as it really was. But, you know, for me, it was so clear. And sometimes youth and young adults don't have that clear vision at a young age. Oh. And so I always encourage people to, you know, I was lucky to discover early what I was really interested in. Yeah. In fact, you mentioned that you were not as young to find that out. But you just keep looking for information. Keep being this sponge. Keep taking advantage of any place that you can learn about an occupation or a job. Be this giant sponge to get this data. And boom, someday you will find what makes you joyful. And you want to find what makes you joyful because it's not going to always be easy to get there.
No.
And, you know, if you're joyful about something, you will develop grit. You will develop this wildly creative mind to do anything you can to get to that point. And so the little boy didn't know that at the time.
Right.
But when I look back at those pictures and see that big smile on my face, I mean, that's exactly what I was experiencing. And that's why those setbacks along the way, you know, okay, I was sad for a day, but, you know, just the next day recovered and pivoted and was creative and kept moving.
What a glorious life's journey that you've had.
It was fun.
Yeah, I can. It's fun. It's fun. Uh-huh. It's fun chatting with you uh-huh. about it. So I've learned so much, so inspiring. And thank you so much for being so open and sharing all of these stories. And I will start working on wasting less time. But anyway, thank you so much for spending your time with us today on Sports Life Balance.
Hey, John, thank you so much. I've listened to all your episodes. I've learned so much from your guests and from you. So thank you.
Cheers. Thanks. When I asked Steve for a quote that inspires him, he gave me a whole list that he's compiled through the years. But the one he selected for this episode is from author, aviator, and wife of Charles Lindbergh, Anne Morrow Lindbergh. On finding happiness and balance in life, she wrote, "Simplification is the road to harmony." I'm John Moffett, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Steve as much as I did. If you'd like to find out more about him, his website is astronautstevesmith.com. If you were inspired by this episode, give us your 5-star review, and please tell a friend. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed Sports Life Balance.